It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we explore the conditions that have some people calling Milwaukee a hub of human trafficking.
First, the third annual open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act is underway. And for those seeking coverage starting in January of 2016, there's only a few more weeks to take action. But since healthcare.gov went live, there's one group of Americans that's been reluctant to sign up for plans. Young people.
The success of the ACA depends on young, healthy people signing up for health care plans, but a variety of factors, including cost, has kept many from getting coverage. So is there anything that can be done to change that?
Justin Sidnor joins us now. He's an economist and associate professor at Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how important are young people to the success of the Affordable Care Act?
They're important, but it's also important not to overstate their importance. The way the system is designed is that having enough young people in helps to keep the average cost of all the plans down. And the way to think about it is that typically a 64-year-old is going to have about five times as much health spending as a 21-year-old. But in the Affordable Care Act, it's designed so that those 64-year-olds only pay about three times more than the 21-year-olds. So having those 21-year-olds in there, and in general, anybody under the age of 34, is important to hold down the average cost of plans.
Well, we've heard a lot about how important young, healthy people are to the success of the Affordable Care Act, and you're saying, yeah, they are important, but they're maybe not as important as we sometimes might tend to overstate it. Why is that?
Yeah, well, the way to think about it is that there is this underlying health gradient even in the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, one thing to know is that there's, you know, the older people are paying about three times more than the younger people for their plans. Mostly estimates suggest that if younger people were signing up at rates equal to what the older individuals are, that it would probably reduce the overall costs of the plans by about 2%. And that's a big number, but it's not catastrophic to the way the ACA works. And it's important to remember that about 28% of the people who are signing up for plans are in the younger category. It's just that it should be about 40% if they were signing up as often as everybody else.
Okay, now that we've got all that out on the table, what are the biggest factors that might stop younger people, healthy people, from getting coverage?
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things. So the first is, I think, an unawareness of what's available out there. And I think that's especially relevant for younger people who have lower incomes. For instance, if you work full-time as a single individual and you make, say, $11 an hour or less, the subsidies that are out there for you actually make the health insurance a really good deal. And I think most of the people who aren't signing up who are in that group are probably just unaware of just what they could get. And surveys show that many of them haven't actually looked at the healthcare.gov system. So there are many people who don't understand what's available. So that's one group. The other reason, though, is, you know, many people cite high costs. And I think that's a true thing. It's important to recognize that for other people making a little bit more money. So, for instance, if you're working full-time and you're making, say, $15 an hour or more as an individual, you're going to have to pay the full cost of your health insurance. And that's going to run somewhere between $1,500 to $2,500 for the year for a bronze or a silver plan. So let's call that about $2,000 a year. And for many people, I think that $2,000 a year is a very big number for them to wrestle with, and they haven't necessarily budgeted for that as part of their yearly spending.
Right, and one critique of the barriers to coverage is that the plans can still be confusing to some people, especially maybe younger people who might not be familiar with the jargon. A recent Milwaukee Journal Sentinel article quoted a young woman who said she could handle the insurance, but her deductible was pretty big when she had a medication that she needed. So the idea there, maybe she had the wrong plan. Maybe she could have been on a more cost-effective plan. So could the Affordable Care Act or the government have done a better job of helping people navigate the plans?
So I think the answer to that is definitely yes. And things are moving in this direction of giving people better information about what the plans really cover and what to expect. But all the evidence we have so far is that right now, health insurance as it's currently structured and the way that the exchanges work is very complicated and very hard for most people to understand. But I also think there's an important thing in what that young woman said that's worth thinking a bit about. And, you know, what she was highlighting there was that to her, the health insurance really didn't seem very valuable because she was still having to pay these high costs that she didn't fully understand for things like prescription drugs. And I think one thing to note is that most of the plans that people will be buying on the Affordable Care Act exchanges are really the types of plans that you should think of as covering you for really bad financial outcomes if you get very sick. And they're offering less valuable coverage for what you might call more modest sickness. Most of the plans have very high deductibles. So it's really important to think about the value they provide is if you get very sick and you run up $50,000 worth of hospital bills, and they just aren't actually all that valuable for a modest level of routine needs.
We're talking with Justin Sidner right now, economist and associate professor at the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. We're talking about some of the reasons why young people may not be signing up under the Affordable Care Act and what's at stake there. And Justin, as someone who looks at risk management, what's the economic argument for someone to buy maybe a $200 a month plan when they hardly ever go to the doctor?
Yeah, so this is actually a classic place where economists and, let's call it, everyone else think very differently. So most people struggle with the idea of insurance because it feels often like they're not, you know, quote, getting anything for their insurance. So for a lot of people, the idea of paying a premium every month and then with very high likelihood not actually using it or getting something from the insurance is very painful. For an economist, though, the way we think about this is that if I buy one of these insurance plans, I'm going to pay my $200 a month. And what I'm protecting myself against really is that about 1 in 20 chance, if I'm a healthy young person, I'd have about a 1 in 20 chance of something really bad happening during the year that might rack up, say, $50,000 worth of insurance bills. And so the economic argument is that it's worth paying that, call it $2,000 for the year for sure, to avoid the possibility of a $50,000 loss, because that $50,000 hit is something that's going to more dramatically change your life. You're likely to be in debt for a very long time. It may postpone your ability to buy your first house if you're a young person. And so the negatives of that large $50,000 expenditure far outweigh the regular safe expenditure of $2,000. So that's the economic argument, but it doesn't often feel intuitive to a lot of people.
And then there's the penalty for not signing up, and that is actually going up some this year. Does it need to go higher, do you think, in order to get more young people to sign up?
I actually think it's getting close to the point where it's going to really impact many younger people to signing up. So, for instance, this year the individual penalty for not purchasing a plan is $700 for the year. And if you think about it, many of these younger people could have a fairly decent catastrophic plan, a bronze plan, that would cover in these events of really large hospital costs. And that plan will cost about $1,500 for the year. And so if you consider either paying $1,500 for the year and having insurance against really big losses, plus some coverage for routine preventative care, or paying $700 in a penalty for which you get nothing, I think that calculation is going to start actually switching to the extent that people understand what's available to them, that they could have these $1,500 a year insurance plans, and that they understand what the penalty they're going to be facing is.
Justin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to be on. Thank you very much.
That was Justin Sidner, economist and associate professor at Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about some of the reasons why young people may not be signing up under the Affordable Care Act and what's at stake. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
The issue of human trafficking hit home last month after an FBI sting operation rescued 9 adolescents from commercial sexual exploitation. Reports show that human trafficking isn't a new issue. Over the last 4 years, Milwaukee has ranked in the top 5 cities in the country for the recovery of trafficked adolescents.
We're joined now by freelance reporter Zoe Sullivan. Her piece titled "Hub of Human Trafficking, Underground Sex Trade Thrives in Milwaukee" recently appeared in The Guardian. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, can you give us some details on that October raid, which really drew attention to Milwaukee and this issue of human trafficking?
Sure. So every year, the FBI does a raid nationally. They organize stings all over the country. And over the course of a week, they basically attempt to arrest people who are purchasing sex. In Milwaukee, they actually ran their operation between Thursday and early Sunday morning, so they didn't even run it for a full week, and they ended up coming up with 9 people.
Now, when we think of human trafficking, a lot of times I think people hear that phrase and think of international smuggling of people across borders. That's not the definition as defined in these reports we're talking about.
Right, right. So trafficking is, where minors are concerned, it's actually just the, you know, being involved in a commercial sex act. And so because minors are not legally able to give consent to sexual activity, any sort of commercial sexual act is considered trafficking for a minor.
Now, you write that the chair of the Human Trafficking Task Force of Greater Milwaukee says, you know, we see these numbers. It's hard to know if they're accurate. They're probably not. They worry that the numbers are undercounted. Why is that?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I mean, one, there was a report that came out in 2013 evaluating contacts that the Milwaukee Police Department had with young people who were later identified as victims of trafficking. And there were 77 contacts reported with police officers prior to them being identified as trafficking victims. So right there, that raises the question of why were the police not identifying, you know, these young people? And you know, if these people were being stopped, for example, for loitering or for jaywalking or for, you know, breaking curfew or whatever it was, you know, how many other people are out there and not being identified for whatever reason?
Now, you write that this whole issue really is something that people don't want to talk about, especially when it comes to the specifics that we'll get into of who is targeted by traffickers, what leads up to this. Why is this something we're not keen on talking about?
I think there are a lot of reasons. I mean, one, I think that generally as a culture, we're actually really prudish about sex. And so anything that has to do with sex is something that we don't really want to discuss. And then when you talk about, you know, the exploitation of minors, for example, in a sexual way, that just tends to make people pretty uncomfortable. Trafficking is not limited to minors. It's not limited to girls. It affects people of all, you know, many ages, races, and genders. So I think what's important is to understand what makes people more vulnerable to situations of trafficking, but also, you know, where is it present? And actually, one of the things, I know I'm just kind of going on, but one of the things that that advocates told me in my research for this story is that actually people from Milwaukee are being trafficked all over the state. And just this week, there was a report in the Wausau Daily Herald about a woman from Wausau who was trafficked. So I think there's also this misconception that this is an urban problem, and it's not. It's actually much more widespread.
Talking to reporter Zoe Sullivan about her piece, Hub of Human Trafficking, Underground Sex Trade Thrives in Milwaukee. It appeared in The Guardian. Well, let's get into what you just mentioned. Some of the causes, the factors that might lead to someone being targeted by traffickers informally. We would call these people pimps.
Right. Yeah. So one thing that came up in basically every interview that I did was that pimps are well known for basically cruising outside of group homes and foster homes in Milwaukee, looking for young people who are somehow disaffected and consequently more open to being sort of lured into not directly into commercial sex, but to someone who says, oh, I'm going to take care of you, or I can give you a place to stay tonight, or whatever it may be. And, you know, because they may be disaffected with their environment, they're more vulnerable to that kind of offer. Additionally, you know, sexual molestation makes people more vulnerable to exploitation by traffickers. Certainly mental health issues does as well. Poverty also. So there are a whole range of factors that really make this a complicated issue.
So young people, as you say, maybe sexually abused, maybe poverty background, people without a lot of bright positive alternatives there who might be willing more willing to hear that sales pitch, in effect, from the pimp about what they can provide for them.
Right. And, you know, physical abuse is another one. One of the things that some of the advocates said to me, the Milwaukee Homicide Review report made it pretty clear that 88% of the young people who they identified were African Americans. The majority lived on the North Side. The majority were female. But some of the advocates I spoke with said, you know, there are also people from Mequon who get involved with this. And it can be, you know, drug addiction. It can be mental health issues. It can be, you know, whatever issues at home, lack of parental supervision, whatever it may be, that basically makes it possible for a young person to get sucked in, really.
Now, what do we know, if anything, about who goes into the trafficking side?
That's a good question. I don't know a whole lot about that. What I did learn during my reporting in Milwaukee is that there are family-based networks. And so it's not just an individual pimp necessarily with one woman or a group of women or girls, but there are well-organized networks. And I think that's one of the reasons why Milwaukee, you know, is quote-unquote a hub for human trafficking. I mean, women and girls have been reported from Milwaukee and Wisconsin, in North Dakota, in Las Vegas, you know, in Louisiana. So it's not just staying in Milwaukee.
And one advocate, I think you wrote, referred to Milwaukee as the Harvard of pimping in a lot of ways. People are trading tips. They get together almost for informal conferences on how to recruit and control their victims.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel actually published a report before my piece came out about these pimp roundtables that happen or were happening in Milwaukee, where there are business discussions, you know, about who's working with who and how do you control them, et cetera, et cetera. So it is coordinated, it is organized. And I think that's one of the things that also makes it complicated in Milwaukee is that it's embedded in the community. And I think some people don't necessarily recognize that that's what's going on, you know, with their neighbors or their family members or their friends. And it's hard to think that, you know, people you know and care about may be doing something that is not only illegal, but immoral.
Let's get to the enforcement side of things now. There's been talk anyway, nationally, even internationally, of a change from treating the underage victims here, the people being trafficked, as criminals themselves. Are we seeing that here in the state, in Milwaukee in particular?
Yes. So I think there's more understanding of what's going on. Wisconsin does not have a safe harbor law, which basically says that anyone under the age of 18 who is, you know, caught in an act of commercial sex is not a prostitute, so they're not subject to legal charges. However, the Milwaukee Police Department just received a $1.5 million grant from the Department of Justice to work on these issues in conjunction with the Sojourner Truth Family Peace Center. And I presume that they're educating their officers, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, there is definitely work to be done in that area.
And one of the challenges, again, you write about this, is that, okay, even if we're not treating this victim of sex, of human trafficking, of sex trafficking as the criminal, we want to help. Often they're from a neighborhood that has no job alternatives, not much else for them to turn to. So people are trying to take a wider approach to this.
Yeah, as they should. One of the things that came up again in the Milwaukee Homicide Review report is that 70% of the young people who had been identified as trafficked had been reported missing at some point. And so one of the recommendations that came up from the report is there needs to be some examination of what happens with missing children and missing people reports. Because if this large a number of people who are being trafficked are being identified as missing and somehow they're falling through the cracks and no one is sort of picking up on that and finding ways to help them, that's a pretty serious failing. And law enforcement is not going to be adequate to deal with these problems. There have to be other kinds of structures.
Now, how about enforcement efforts against the traffickers, the pimps themselves?
You know, I unfortunately was not able to speak with the Milwaukee Police Department, so I can only, you know, talk a little bit about the conversation that I had with the FBI. They're definitely working on it. And as I said, I mean, it is a national campaign. I do think, however, that one of the things that as the public, it's important to think about is who's doing the buying This is not something that's happening in a few locations. There's a report that actually came out in Minneapolis called Mapping the Market that basically established that it's predominantly men who are buying sex. They're coming from all racial and ethnic communities and from all socioeconomic levels. And the advocates I've spoken with have said, you know, commercial sex is happening and people are being trafficked all over the state of Wisconsin. So again, you know, what's happening in our own communities where maybe we wouldn't think that this is something that's going on, but it is.
A hard question to answer to wrap up with, maybe, since the numbers are hard to determine. Is there a sense, though, in Milwaukee that things are getting worse?
That's hard for me to say. I mean, clearly, if the police department is getting a $1.5 million grant, I don't know if they're getting worse. But certainly the federal government recognizes that there's a need to do something. There was just a report, and this is not Milwaukee, but there was just a report that came from Duluth of an Eau Claire woman who was trafficked to Duluth, for example. So again, it is happening all over the place, and I think being aware and trying to recognize those signs is important.
Zoe, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was journalist Zoe Sullivan discussing her recent piece on sex trafficking in Milwaukee.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Just a couple decades ago, if you went looking for grains at the grocery store, you'd find rice, oats, and that's probably about it. But today there are so many healthy and wonderful grains available, you don't have to go to a specialty store to find them.
Our guest now on Food Friday is hoping that with a little info and some great recipes to try, these grains will find themselves on all our tables.
Terry Milligan joins us now. She's a chef, culinary instructor, and food writer, and she teaches classes at various locations around the state, including the Milwaukee Public Market. She frequently writes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel food section and has a featured quarterly article in the food magazine Edible Door. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So when we talk about whole grains, what falls under that category?
Well, a whole grain is actually a grain that's in its natural state. It has to have three components, which would be the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. So you have to have all three of those, and that makes a whole grain. And what happens a lot is some of these grains don't have the bran and the germ in with them, and then you lose 25% of the grain's protein value. So that's why you want to look for something that says a whole grain. It doesn't have to be like a whole big grain. It could be ground and still be a whole grain. It just means they ground up all three of those pieces of the grain. So that's why you look for whole grains.
And for the purposes of our conversation, and I think the way a lot of people cook, we're going to talk about some things that we cook like grains, we serve like grains. They're not technically grains, right?
They're kind of pseudo-grains, we call them. So, you know, people think of them as grains. So let me say wild rice. People think of wild rice as a grain. It's really an aquatic grass. So that's why you see the pictures of Indians harvesting the wild rice and they're canoeing, because it's an seed of an aquatic grass. So there's some of those that people just throw into the grain category when technically they're not really grains. But I just like to see people eat whole foods like that, so I let them get away with it.
So is there evidence that these whole grains are kind of picking up in popularity these days?
Oh, I think there's definite evidence with that. I mean, you can see it everywhere from magazines that probably never would have had anything about kamut in it, you know, 12, 10, 5 years ago. And now you're seeing those types of things coming up. Now, not everybody knows what it is, and that's why I'm here to talk to you. But there are lots of those whole grains coming into the mainstream that you're hearing about.
Yeah, let's name some more names. You mentioned kamut. What are some of the other interesting grains or grain-like plants that we should maybe try cooking with?
Well, one of the best that has a lot of nutritional value is wheat berry, because that is the berry, the entire wheat kernel except the hull. So it's all three of those things I talked about, but it's not ground down. So it becomes, once it's cooked, and they do take a little longer to cook some of these whole grains, but it's a nice kind of chewy texture. So for those of us who might be wanting to substitute some of these grains for meat and poultry and, you know, being more vegetarian in your diet, it gives you that kind of chew that you're looking for. So wheat berry is a great one. Another one of my favorites is farro. And farro is something that, again, is coming into the mainstream a little bit more, originated in the Fertile Crescent over in what really is kind of that Egypt, Syrian, Lebanon area. But it is a grain that you're seeing a lot more of.
I recently decided to try out a recipe I just happened across. It was for a farro salad. It had some cheese and some apple cider in the broth. It was really yummy, but I had to do a little bit of wandering around my grocery store aisles to find it. I did find it, but how available are these grains?
It kind of depends on your grocery store. Sometimes you'll find these grains in with the cereal section. Sometimes I find that they're over in the more kind of the health food, so to speak, area. So you do have to do a little bit of investigative work, I guess I'd call it. But the other nice thing is if you're in a larger area, such as a Milwaukee or Madison, there's lots of grocery stores or stores that are co-ops maybe that would be focusing on those types of grains, and you can find them actually in the big bin format, so you can buy just what you need, and you don't have to store more than you need.
Let's talk about cooking with some of these different grains. I'm sure it varies from grain to grain, but as far as function on our plate, what kind of things can we substitute in these different kinds of grains for?
Well, you can easily substitute them as a main course. The farro we talked about for a minute is great as a risotto. So instead of using the arboreal rice, I use farro and add some sweet corn and some shiitake mushrooms, and it becomes kind of the same type of thing that you would do with an arboreal rice, where you add some liquid a little bit at a time. You do the same thing with the farro. It becomes a little creamy, and it's a nice thing that you could have just as an entree or serve it with a protein like a grilled fish or grilled chicken. So that's a nice way to add some grains to your diet. Salads, you also mentioned, and any of these grains work great in salads. And you also can use them in things for your breakfast items. Expand your oatmeal and add a few of these other grains like quinoa and amaranth in with it.
We're talking to Terry Milligan about expanding our grain horizons, things like farro, quinoa, amaranth, millet, and lots more. By the way, we've got a recipe, which she was just talking about there, to cook with farro. It is farro risotto with corn and wild mushrooms that Terry provided us. Again, that's over on the Central Time Facebook page. You can try it out this weekend.
And let's talk a little bit about that recipe, Terry. I've made homemade risotto before, and I love it, but I don't like the part where I'm standing at my stove and I'm stirring it for an hour. Do you have to do the same thing with the farro, or does it come together differently?
Well, there is some stirring involved. It takes a little less stirring. It's about 25 to 30 minutes total cooking time to make, but I always think that you can be in the kitchen, but you don't have to be constantly stirring. Just kind of keep an eye on it. When that stock is absorbed, add a little bit more, but it's not kind of the same stirring forever as the traditional risotto made with arboreal rice.
So how else does that one come together, and how does it taste when it's done compared to a traditional risotto?
Well, the farro, to me, gives it an earthy flavor, especially when we add the wild mushrooms to it. So the creaminess, it's not as creamy as the arboreal rice. That rice is specific to risotto because it does exude kind of that creamy texture from the starch. So this won't be quite as creamy, but there is a little creaminess to it. But it does have a bigger chew to it. And as I said, that really kind of earthy flavor.
Now, Terry, sometimes I want my grains to be hearty and earthy and maybe chewy. And then sometimes I don't. Sometimes I want something on a par with white rice to go with something, maybe a stir fry on top of it. Are there some alternatives that might have a little more nutritional value than that white rice that still have like a light feel to them?
Well, I think quinoa is a great one that has a lighter feel. And most people, that's a grain that they are more familiar with because it was one of the first grains that came around into the cooking world that became a little bit more mainstream. The other nice thing with quinoa is it cooks very fast, so you can cook some quinoa in probably 10 minutes, and it's also gluten-free. So you get a little bit more texture probably than a rice, but a lot more of your nutritional value than you would with just a white rice in particular.
Yeah, quinoa, it's all over the place these days. Some people are talking about it as a superfood. What is the nutritional breakdown in quinoa?
Oh, I knew you'd ask me that, and I don't know that.
It's just very good for you.
It's called the superfood because it has all 9 of the essential amino acids in it. So that's why they call it the superfood. I don't know the exact breakdown on the top of my head, but that is why the superfood kind of name has come with quinoa.
And it is high in protein, right?
Oh, it's extremely high in protein, and it's also available now in a lot of different colors. So you can get black quinoa and red quinoa, the traditional kind of white quinoa. Some of them take the darker colors take just a tad longer to cook, but all are very nutritious. Now, that is actually a seed. So that's one of our pseudo-grains.
We're talking about grains and pseudo-grains today with Chef Terry Milligan. She's helping us expand our horizons, and we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite whole grain that you cook with? How did you discover it? How do you prepare it? Do you have a question about how to work with it? Maybe you tried it and went wrong, but you want to try it again. Terry might have some advice for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post and find some recipes over at the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll be back with Terry and with your questions soon. And right now, a few headlines we're keeping an eye on with Kristen Durst from WPR News.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Chef Terry Milligan about using whole grains in our cooking. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you interested in whole grains but not sure where to start? Or have you started your foray into cooking with these grains and pseudo-grains? What kinds of experiences have you had? Good stuff coming out of your kitchen, let us know. And if you have questions about which grains will work well when you need to be able to make a fast, healthy meal, let us know that, too. Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And at the Facebook page, we have a couple recipes. We mentioned already the farro risotto with corn and wild mushrooms. Now, Terry, we've also got, you sent us wheat berry and wild rice salad stuffed winter squash. I love squash. I love the idea of stuffed squash. Talk us through this recipe.
Well, I can not only talk you through the recipe, I have a video on that recipe, too. So you can go on my website and actually see me make it. So that helps listeners actually see how to work with the grains as well. But with this, I always like to have an edible receptacle if I can. So in this case, it's an acorn squash. So I used acorn squash. I picked 2 different grains. It's up to you what you like, but I did the wheat berries. Sometimes I use kamut, which I talked about before, kind of a chewy grain. And I used wild rice. And then I added some steamed sweet potatoes, some dried fruit. I used Door County cherries because that's where I'm from in Door County, but you can use whatever dried fruit you want. So kind of toss that together to create a salad, put it in some steamed squash, and just pop it back in the oven, and you have a whole meal in an edible receptacle.
I was trying to bring to mind wheat berries. You said they're a little chewier. So what is the cooking process like on those guys?
Well, wheat berries are some of these grains that are true whole grains do benefit from a soak. So that's one that some people will soak overnight or for a couple of hours in cold water just to kind of soften it up. But berries such as wheat berries, which have all 3 of the components of a grain still intact, do take about an hour to cook. So basically, you're just simmering them in water on the stove with enough water. If the water goes down a little, you just add a little bit more kind of hot water from a kettle until those berries, those wheat berries are firm, but you can bite them like an al dente kind of pasta, firm to the touch but cooked through. So those types of berries do take a little bit longer than something like a quinoa, which is the seed that takes just a few 10, 15 minutes.
We had a caller, Mary, who called into us at 800-642-1234. I couldn't stay on, but she says she wants to get into, doesn't know that she wants to get into these fancy rices and grains. So she's wondering if she could just cook some white rice, but maybe put some ground flax seeds in the mix to give it a little more nutrition. How do you think that might work out, Terry?
Well, I think that would work well. Flaxseed is one of those items that does benefit, and she said ground, and that's how you really want to see those flax seeds, ground. That's how you're going to be able to absorb more of the nutrition from the flaxseed. So I think that would work out nicely for her.
But do you want to give her a little pep talk to try some of those fancy rices and grains? Because that's what you're shooting for here.
I think she should move away. She can go start, just if she wants to stay in the rice realm, try something like a red Himalaya rice, which is going to have some more nutritional value, but still in the rice category. So you're going to cook it like a rice, and you could add that even to the white rice. So you kind of meld it into your diet. But that red Himalaya rice is very easy to find. There's also a black rice that's around, a little bit more for the more adventurous. I think she's more on, let's just get her into a few of these.
Well, I am big time into soups right now. What do you recommend for a grain that might make a nice sub out for rice in a soup?
Well, again, for a rice in the soup, I would go for something like the Himalaya, which is a little chewier. For grains in a soup, again, I'd go for one of those chewier grains, and that's because you're going to be heating and simmering the soup. If you put something like a quinoa in a soup, it's very tender, and if you cook it too long, it's going to break down. You could add it right at the end. But something like a bulgur or the kamut, the wheat berry, farro, you've talked about that. That would be a great one for the soup. So those hold up well for a simmering type of a meal.
How about barley? I used to like barley. Haven't tried cooking with it in a good long time. If I want to experiment, what would be a good thing to try out with some barley?
Well, barley's great in soup, too, and stews. So those are two things that you could use your barley for. Again, it's a heartier soup, a heartier grain. It does contain gluten, but it's lower in gluten than a lot of the other grains. So for those of you who have to watch that a little bit, the barley, though, again, has gluten, a little lower in the gluten content. But barley, even in a mix with the rice, would be nice.
We're talking with Chef Terry Milligan right now. She's got some ideas about how to cook and start enjoying whole grains in our kitchens and our lives. And Terry, I want to ask you about protein. A lot of people are trying to cut down a little bit on meat these days. Are these whole grains, some of them you mentioned quinoa, that are kind of packing a bigger punch for protein? Is that a good way to go if you want to cut down on meat? Can you sub in some of these grains?
Well, definitely a lot of the grains have a lot of protein. You mentioned quinoa. Amaranth is also a very high in protein grain. And that's, again, kind of a pseudo grain. It's a seed and very small, but it's easy to add to things like if you're making, if you are a mom and you want to make your own granola bars, adding a little of that amaranth is in there is a great way to add some protein, magnesium, some antioxidants. So those are two that are really great with the proteins.
I wanted to ask you and maybe see if you can convert me on something, Terry. I once tried cooking with millet. And I'll say I used to work a long time ago at a store that sold bird seed. And when I ate the millet, I thought, yeah, I'm eating warmed up bird seed here. This is really unexciting. What's a good way to eat
well,
some millet?
That's funny because when I used to own a restaurant, and about 15 years ago, I made something for the restaurant, a burger, a vegetable burger, and used millet. And my I was the only woman. All my male chefs were always kidded me about the bird seed in the So it is actually dates back. It's one of our oldest seeds. It is gluten-free, but it dates back to West Asia about 10,000 years ago. And it is a staple in African, Indian, and China diets and very high in zinc and vitamin B. But it is used in the West, as you said, as bird food a lot. But it is very quick cooking. So I think it's just a matter of adding it to something else. I don't think it's something that you're going to be sitting around eating a bowl of millet. But you could add that even into things to get some more nutrition into even a meatloaf. Add a few grains into the meatloaf. Get the kids to get some of those grains, but they don't really know they're getting them because it's mixed in with meatloaf or meatballs.
Can you do anything kind of desserty and fun? Is if you really want to get distance yourself from the whole bird seed metaphor, can you do kind of decadent things with grains at all?
Well, you can definitely do things with quinoa and make like a what we would refer to as a rice pudding, but using some of these grains, like a, more of a quick cooking grain like a quinoa. Cornmeal is considered a grain, and there's a lot of things you can do with that. I am doing something for a little get-together for Edible Door magazine in a couple of days, and I made a cornmeal cake made with olive oil and rosemary, but it's a dessert cake. I threw a little Grand Marnier in it, too.
Sounds pretty good.
Because it is the holidays. But you can definitely use those whole grains, like the cornmeal and something like that.
As far as combinations go, too, I know in that wheat, berry, and wild rice salad that we put in winter squash, I think you've got some nuts and fruit in this mixture. It seems like a lot of these grains are things that would go well with various kinds of nuts, maybe dried fruits.
Dried fruits go great because you get that sweetness to go with it, too. So that's a nice addition. I have on my website a tabbouleh salad that uses traditional bulgur, adds the quinoa, but then I roasted eggplant to put in with it, too. So kind of adding a little bit more dimension to a traditional preparation.
Now, one of our callers used the word fancy when describing these grains. Is that fair, and do they cost more than the other ones?
Again, depends on the grain. I find that some of them are very reasonable. I just went to our Whole Foods store here in Door County and got some kamut, and it was less than $3 for a pound. But then if you go and try to find quinoa, it's gone very expensive. One of the reasons for quinoa being expensive is that it is a seed that grows in a high elevation, and it's hard to grow. And the other thing is it is very being used a lot. So you're finding some of these grains like that being a little bit more expensive. But I think things like the bulgur, barley, cornmeal, things like that are certainly in the price range that people can afford.
Well, Terry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
That was Chef Terry Milligan sharing her ideas with us about how to cook and enjoy whole grains. Her recipes for farro risotto with corn and wild mushrooms and wheat, berry, and wild rice salad stuffed winter squash. You can find all of those on the Central Time Facebook page. There are a lot of traditions around Thanksgiving, and it's not all about the food. There's also a lot of stuff on TV, like the Macy's Parade, and of course, a lot of football.
We had the parade on for a part of the morning yesterday. The less said about the Packers game, the better. But we always spent some time with the National Dog Show on, at least in the background.
Over 1,700 dogs started out the events, but in the end, there can be only one.
And best in show tonight is the Skye Terrier.
The Skye Terrier, best in show.
How about that? The beautiful Skye Terrier, his 79th best in show.
The big winner, Charlie, the Skye Terrier from Florida. That's S-K-Y-E, as in the Isle of Skye in Scotland, where the breed is from.
Now, that guy said it was beautiful. I would beg to differ. That's the wrong word. That dog was cute.
Yeah?
That dog was
yeah, you were a fan
cute.
When I pulled the picture up of my computer.
Right, if you had a little mop and you had it walk around the floor with probably better grooming than your average mop,
well,
that
yeah.
was a Skye Terrier.
Hopefully smelling better than the average household mop.
It was a dog. Have you ever seen a Skye Terrier
I don't
before?
Know that I have one in person. I probably haven't online
right.
either.
I hadn't come across them before. That is adorable.
Would you, given the opportunity, and these are rare, I understand, would you want a Skye Terrier as
oh, yeah.
your next dog?
I would, you know, right after Winston, who you know is going to be my next dog.
And Winston, the hypothetical.
Yes, Winston is a West Highland White. That's the kind of dog I want. But after that, yeah, how about a Skye Terrier?
All
I'm
right,
in.
The elaborate pet fantasy world. Coming up, news from NPR and WPR, then we'll get the latest and the biggest stories from around the state this week in the Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.